Good morning and welcome to an Aloha Friday on The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and good morning to you, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. It's good to be reminded that one person can make a difference.
One person, and one person in concert with another person and another person, and so it goes.
Exactly.
Now, in the summer of 2013, Patrice Cullors was devastated by the verdict of not guilty in the trial of George Zimmerman for the killing of Trayvon Martin. She cried, she took to social media, and was galvanized by a post from a friend that ended Black Lives Matter. It instantly became a hashtag, then a movement. Now, 3.5 years later, the movement, which she co-founded, is continuing to redefine itself. Patrice Cullors is in Honolulu for the screening and panel discussion of Ava DuVernay's film 13th this morning. Patrice Cullors is in our studio, and welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We live now in a very changed political climate. Right after Donald Trump's election, you wrote in The Guardian expressing your fear and sadness and anger in an opinion piece. And you said that your work has become clearer and harder. How is that work evolving now?
Well, we're in a moment where we've seen over 23 executive orders from the Trump presidency. Those executive orders have threatened the lives of undocumented people, immigrant communities, Black people, women. And we're also seeing a resistance movement. We're seeing organizations and movements join together to say enough is enough. We will not allow this presidency to deter us. And I think as much as it's devastating, there is a significant amount of beauty.
Does that also speak to the idea that we are in a point where it's moving into the all lives matter, which has taken a lot of, you know, hits and criticism from Black Lives Matter as being aspirational, but not necessarily truly, you know, practical in terms of what the movement itself was trying to do. But in this moment of what you see as more collaboration, is it moving into that sphere?
Well, what we've seen All Lives Matter be used for is to derail a conversation about anti-Black racism. When I say our movements are joining together, I don't mean that we're diluting the messages of each movement and the specificities of our oppression. In fact, I think our movements are joining together to say each one of us, our communities are being targeted in this specific way. We have more strength as a unit than we do separately.
For that joining together of movements, we've seen Black Lives Matter blossom over the last 3.5 years around the country and around the world. Where and how is Black Lives Matter moving in those places to coalesce with other communities? Which communities are you, in fact, coalescing with?
Yeah, on the mainland, you're seeing the immigrants' rights community and Black Lives Matter join together. We're also seeing there be a more specific conversation about how anti-Black racism exists even in the immigrants' rights movement. Right. There's this idea that Black folks aren't actually undocumented, but that's not true. We have people from the Caribbean. We have people from the continent of Africa, from Sudan, from Somali, who are being deeply impacted by this moment, doubly impacted by the Muslim ban and by anti-Black racism and the policing of our communities. So you're seeing that connection. You're also seeing groups in our community, like the LGBT community, joining together, the women's rights movement that's bubbling and blossoming in this moment. And you're seeing us develop new relationships with people outside of the U.S. borders, folks inside Canada and the United Kingdom. Everybody sees Donald Trump as a threat to their existence, not just in our country, but also across the world.
We're also being watched by the rest of the world, too, not just by those who are involved with the movement, but by nations. Has there been any conversation that you've been able to glean from those who are in the movement around the country about how, and around the world, about how the view toward America is changing differently from what we see turn up in news streams?
I think what we are seeing is that folks from other nations clearly understand that that the U.S. is being led in a way that is in direct contradiction from many people on the ground. The moment that Donald Trump was elected, people hit the streets. That is incredibly powerful. The day of his inauguration, people were protesting. Black Lives Matter, our D.C. chapter, and the movement for Black Lives inside of D.C. Were protesting at his inauguration in collaboration with environmental justice groups. The day after was the Women's March, which was some of the largest numbers of people coming out on the streets across the globe. You're seeing global resistance to Donald Trump.
You've characterized the way he wants to rule the country as being, you know, a police state and a state of law and order. In looking at it through that lens, is there any way of being able to see police reform?
That's a really good question. I think what we know is that the fight has to be local. There's going to be very little movement on holding police accountable at the federal level, where we had the DOJ during the Obama administration that was coming in and really challenging local law enforcement. That's not going to happen during this presidency. And so the work that we are really pushing for is both cities and counties, but also states, like my state in California, who has been hugely oppositional to Donald Trump and really his cabinet. And we've seen deep movement in the state of California, as well as the city of Los Angeles, where we're saying, this is a sanctuary city, this is a sanctuary state. And I think we're going to need to request more cities, more states to stand up against the rise of Donald Trump and his administration's push and move towards a police state.
We know that some of that conversation is happening within Hawaii, about Hawaii being a sanctuary state. In talking to those of Black Lives Matter who are operational here in Hawaii, what are you hearing from them in terms of pushing the conversation in a way that perhaps we are not hearing beyond just, oh, this is something that may be occurring in Hawaii?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two threads of the conversation that I've been paying attention to. One is the conversation that's being led by many Black Hawaiians, both who are mixed race but also have lived here, which is Black Lives Matter in the Hawaiian Kingdom. I've been able to have informal and formal conversations with folks who think it's so important to talk about anti-Black racism in this context. The other thread that I've been paying attention to is the Hawaiian sovereignty movement. There are Black folks and Native Hawaiian folks, both groups who have been fighting for the liberation of their communities for centuries. I think those are important moments to have conversations where there are similarities, but also have the conversation where there are differences in our movements.
Hawaii likes to think of itself as being so culturally embracing in its diversity, and yet we know that there are tensions that exist here too. You've just talked about some of them. But are there ways in which you see Hawaii being able to do this better? I mean, we like to think of ourselves as a beacon. Are we?
I don't live here, so I think from an outside vantage point, I think definitely a place like Hawaii can lead both the conversation but also the practice around what it means to be in community, what it means to be in direct relationship with one another. I think part of what that takes is a deep involvement in why we should be joining our movement at this moment. Many of us are scared. We are frightened. Sometimes what that does, it moves us to isolate, right, or further exist in silos. I think right now, with even myself and Alicia coming in later, we have this weekend to talk about and deepen our relationships with one another.
Hawaii has also had a sometimes, you know, frustrated and indifferent relationship with its LGBTQ community. Sometimes it's been very progressive. Sometimes people have shrugged their shoulders and wondered, how could we be talking about this and not acting further? Mm. And yet, you know, we've seen a forward motion. There's also the host culture and a very different approach. How, in that context of conversation and joining together, with some of the threads that you see coming from the Black Lives Matter movement. Do you see that part of the conversation going forward?
Mm-hmm. Well, the LGBTQ community, you know, with Black Lives Matter, two of its founders being queer, openly queer, we've had deep conversations with the LGBT community, often led by the mainstream movement, led by white folks, and why the mainstream LGBTQ movement really needs to think about anti-Black racism and be in better practice with Black communities and communities of color. I think oftentimes when you see tensions, you're seeing a tension around power struggle. People will say, well, you know, talking about LGBTQ issues are a distraction from the real issues. In fact, what we're pushing for is a conversation of those folks who are at the margins. If you're Black, if you're queer, if you're Black and you're trans, you're at the margins. And so how do we have a more intersectional approach to these conversations?
And what does that intersectional approach look like?
It looks like talking about all the ways someone comes inside of this movement. I'm Black, I'm queer, raised working class and poor. We have to have these conversations, and we have to actually center those that are most at the margin in these conversations. If we're just talking about white LGBT communities, we're not actually talking about the ways in which Black, queer, and trans women in particular are subjected to some of the most violent recourse by not just law enforcement, but by civilians as well. And so I think that's a conversation that we really try to challenge people on.
When you talk about those who are marginalized, what comes to mind too are also people who have been leading in the movement for decades, who have been pushed away from the spotlight, mm-hmm. which seems only to be occupied by, you know, guys. Why is it that it seems to be so full of not just paternalism but sexism when there are so many women who throughout movements have been the ones to lead it?
Because we haven't got rid of sexism, and we haven't been able to get rid of patriarchy, and because many people, both men and women alike, are deeply invested in patriarchy and sexism without even realizing it. We come from a long line of women who have been the architects of the movement, like Ella Baker, like Fannie Lou Hamer. We've come from a long line of women who have been on the front lines of this movement, and yet, time and time again, the people who get the visibility and the spotlight are Black men. In this current moment, we are seeing a different approach. Because of social media, Black women have the opportunity to share why we are at the front lines of this movement, why we are the architects. And we are in some of the people who have lifted us up the most have been our elders that are Black women, like Barbara Ransby and Kathy Cohen and Linda Burnham.
This seems to say that Black Lives Matter has both an internal focus in bringing a conversation that is truly representative of the people in it, and led by women, not just by the Al Sharptons of the world, mm-hmm. but also the fact that you're now having to operate, I don't want to call it a war on two fronts, but it seems very much that you have very different and bifurcated focuses on this because you have to be able to bring this together to a point where you can make it work in the way that you see.
I'd agree with you. I think there's always been an age-old struggle of power inside of the civil rights movement and the human rights movement. Who gets to tell the story? Who gets to be on the at the forefront of the story? Who gets to shape the debate and the dialogue? I think the difference now is there's a much more even playing field. I won't say that we've been able to rid patriarchy and sexism in our communities. That would be a lie. But you do get to see women voices, queer voices, trans voices that are shaping the debate and the narrative in ways that you didn't see in the past.
Well, we're glad that we also have been able to share your voice this morning. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Patrice Cullors is the co-founder of Black Lives Matter. She's also a performance artist, Fulbright scholar, and NAACP history maker. She was named by the Los Angeles Times as the civil rights leader of the 21st century. Patrice Cullors is in Honolulu for the screening of 13th and the panel discussion that will follow this Sunday at the Doris Duke Theater.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Locations, Noheia Gallery, and Straub Clinic and Hospital.
Had enough of partisan politics, he said, she said, and showbiz? I'm Ira Flatow. On Science Friday, we deal with facts that really impact your life, like how climate change will affect your neighborhood, what's new in healthcare, why do we know so little about our universe? So join in and become part of an intelligent conversation. Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after The Conversation.
And you're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a challenge for first-time filmmakers. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
In the backyard today, we're reviewing Hawaii's political history. Kalihi native Senator Hiram Fong is one of Hawaii's most notable and accomplished native sons. The seventh of 11 children born to Chinese immigrants, Senator Fong is a prime example of the American dream so many come to the U.S. to achieve. A graduate of Harvard Law School, Senator Fong was elected in 1959 and became the first Asian American to serve in the U.S. Senate. In 1964, he became the first Asian American presidential candidate. His name appears on Honolulu's 100 Most Influential Citizens of the Past Century list, and in recognition, the U.S. Postal Service dedicated the Kapalama Station in his honor. The McKinley High School's business building also carries his name. Our question for today, can you tell us how Senator Fong earned the title of senior senator? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know, or stick around for the answer in the second half of the show.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, announcing a science symposium for girls in grades 5 to 8 on Saturday, February 18th. Registration at sacredhearts.org.
Most filmmakers will tell you that coming up with a great idea for a movie is only a beginning, and that most of a would-be auteur's time is spent trying to raise money. Sad but true, and many an idea has died on the vine. The first annual Hawaii Film Challenge is an international screenwriting contest for 10 to 12-minute short film scripts that hopes to find and develop projects that deserve an audience. Kara Fushita Jovic is the creative director of Hawaii Film Challenge 2017, and she's with us in our studio. Good morning, Kara.
Good morning.
This is the first time you've done this, right?
Yes, it is. So it's the inaugural year.
What is it that you're doing?
Well, what we're doing is we're having a call out for 10 to 12 minute film scripts, so they can be of any genre, so set anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's an international challenge. So the top three winning scripts are going to be fully produced here in Hawaii, with one of the winners being completely dedicated to Hawaii team.
So your script could be set anywhere, but it needs to be shot here.
It needs to be shot here. And all of the script writers who are submitting would have a core team of director, DP, sound, and editor. So the two international teams would be flown, that core team would be flown to Hawaii for the film production.
And when you see, say, for instance, DP and editor, do you mean union certified, How does one certify a DP,
yeah,
an editor?
I mean, ideally, we're working on the details right now, but ideally it would be a mixed set depending on the script, particularly because two out of the three teams will be coming internationally. Mm-hmm. And it is going to be kind of a creative challenge just to do 10 full days of filming and post-production.
But essentially, you provide a director of photography, you, the writer, provide a director of photography, and you folks provide a camera.
Yes, exactly. So the idea is that we're going to be supporting three creative teams of director, DP, sound, and editor, providing all the equipment. We'll be pre-screening and doing the casting, location scouting, but we'll provide supportive crew as well if needed to the three teams.
So your task as creative director is to review a great many scripts, right?
Yes, exactly. So the official dates of the film challenge will be announced during the March 15th official deadline for submissions. Our early bird closes on March 15th, and then the scripts are being accepted through May 15th. But we have people in the film industry, in arts, and we're also looking at the literary community in Hawaii to be vetting the scripts. So there'll be a team looking at all of the scripts that are coming in.
Any idea the kind of thing that is sort of that you're going to be seeing a lot of?
We hope to actually see a huge variety of scripts because we are open to any genre, whether it's narrative or experiential. We had someone contact us recently saying, is it okay that my entire story takes place in one room? Mm-hmm. So we're actually hoping to get a variety of different types of stories.
And it's okay with you if the action takes place in a single room?
Yes, definitely. I think one of our goals is to choose the scripts based on merit, but to have a nice cross-section of different genres. And so whether it takes advantage of Hawaii's beautiful beaches and mountains, or if it's set like an urban Chinatown, yeah. We're really looking for a variety of stories.
One would certainly be tempted to, if you're going to shoot in Hawaii, to get a beach in there at some point, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we've been getting a lot of questions of, does my story have to take place at the beach? And our answer is no. I mean, we're sure we're going to get a lot of those as well. But we're really focused on having good storytelling because we are having, you know, pretty challenging in 10 days to complete this. So we're looking at 2 to 3 days of pre-production, then maybe 7 days, 4 to 7 days of filming with post-production included.
Is it a common sort of shortcoming of script submissions that they're not as shootable as the filmmakers think they will be?
Yes, for sure. That's why I think we're getting a mix of people who, you know, have never done this before versus people who have maybe been more on the commercial side of the industry and just have passion mm-hmm. projects or stories they want to tell. So one of the directions we put on our site is, you know, ideally you would have maybe 3 to 5 main characters. And one of the criteria is going to be, is can it actually be produced during that time?
And so if you have a lot of exteriors, keep in mind that with 5 days shooting, you might get 3 rainy days.
Right, exactly. So we're trying a lot, you know, one rain day here and there to compensate for that. But yeah, I mean, and also, you know, it's a huge challenge, so it's going to be a lot of fun and rewarding. But, you know, that core team really does need to fulfill their roles on set.
Yeah. So if you have a chariot race, it should probably take place off camera, for example. Right?
Exactly.
Well, that is a tricky aspect of writing a movie script, because it takes a certain amount of technical knowledge as to what it takes and how long shots take. I think a lot of new filmmakers are surprised by how long a setup can take.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's why we're partnering with Salt and Air Studios and Hawaii Camera, who's providing the equipment, as well as Kinetic Studios, where we're most likely going to do post-production. So we are going to have people on our team that have experience. So there's this kind of beautiful, you know, whether they're new to the industry or they have a lot of experience, collaboration with people who have been in the industry for a while. So
yeah.
There's a mentorship aspect too.
Which sounds like, from the writer's point of view, that you really could, if your idea were strong enough, get it to fruition if you got the right people around you.
Yes, for sure. And I think that's the challenge, really, is, you know, we can have these really great, amazing stories, but the inspiration for this is how hard it is to bring that to life. You really need a whole team behind you. So I think all of us are very passionate about filmmaking, so it should be both challenging and fun.
You know, I'm sort of a legator. When I was first falling in love with cinema, was the birth of the so-called auteur theory, where it was the strong-willed individual who got movies made. And I think people who grew up behind that are surprised when they go out and make their first movie and find out that they're pretty helpless on their own, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, you can have a vision, but then there's so much that comes together to bring that vision to life. And that's where, you know, both the challenges and the rewards, I think, come in, is just, you know, how do you have that vision and stay true to it while being open to other ideas and collaborating with people?
You know, one of the things that we were talking earlier about what you could do here in Hawaii, this, you could easily make Hawaii be Mars, right?
Right, right.
Old Chinatown would offer you any number of, you know, you could do period pieces, couldn't you?
Right, exactly. I think that's the thing that a lot of people are not aware of outside of Hawaii that we're hoping this challenge will bring to life is, you know, we have such a beautiful landscape, but we're also, Honolulu's a major city, and we have people from all over the world here. So I think it's this beautiful combination of staying true and respectful, you know, to what exists in Hawaii. And then when we're interacting with people outside of Hawaii, making sure that that's, you know, a mutually respectful, you know, collaborative experience. So we're creating things together. And I think that all of us have that kind of in our heart with this challenge.
That's been a difficulty for filmmakers in the past, sort of knowing what true Hawaiian traditions are, right?
Right, exactly. So I do think there's an educational piece to this as well, because all of us are born and raised here. You know, we have someone on our team who's Native Hawaiian. So just, you know, making sure that while we do this, we're doing it in the right way. And I think it's really important to get out what Hawaii really is and what Hawaii is really like, because I don't think you often see that in the media.
What kind of, what kind of ballpark estimate do you have of how many scripts you're going to be looking at in the next few months?
To be honest, we're prepared to have thousands and thousands of scripts, but we're happy, honestly, if we get, you know, three amazing stories. So I think we know this is our first year, and we're kind of prepared, you know, depending if we get a lot or not a lot. I think we're just hoping to get a good variety of scripts.
You're going to have a team of readers that you're going to need to have standing by, right?
Yes, exactly, exactly. So that's kind of what we're working on behind the scenes. We already have our core team together, but we just want to be prepared for a huge influx, which would be amazing.
Well, I think you could get some really exciting results, Kara.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Kara Fujita Jovic is the creative director of Hawaii Film Challenge 2017. It's an international screenwriting contest. Three winners will be provided airfare and lodging for their creative team, as well as casting, production staff, and equipment support for a 10-day shoot and production experience here in Hawaii. Details are on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, currently raising funds for a new kidney resource center in Kapolei and for the Senator Daniel K. Akaka Community Center, kidneyhi.org.
Hi, this is Jason Taglianetti, HPR's Multimedia Production Manager. My go-to programs are the TED Radio Hour and This American Life. If you have programs you gotta listen to, let us help you find them on our two newly formatted stations starting February 14th. We'd love to tell you about some new programs you might enjoy as well. Call us during business hours at 955-8821 or find schedules and more online on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
The rail tax bill as we knew it is changing, so much so that it will require another public hearing. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us now with a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Wow, what a difference a day makes. I mean, we thought they were going to vote on this yesterday, but they elected not to, those two Senate committees. And now it looks like there's a whole just, you know, raft of changes that may happen with these bills.
You know, it's really unusual. I haven't seen something quite like this. It was looking like the bill was going to extend that surcharge for Oahu residents in perpetuity. As you know, it's supposed to sunset in 2027. Now there's talk they may just extend it only to 2032. Money was going to go to the Department of Transportation to help with state highways. That was taken out. Now that could go back in. And there's still some questions about what to do with that administrative fee of 10%, the so-called skim that the state levies on the surcharge. Those are just a handful of the changes. This bill, according to Lorena Noy, the chair of the Senate Transportation and Energy Committee, said it could be heavily amended by the time we see a final version on Monday.
So at this point, do we have any indication about how those amendments may be, you know, maybe looking aside from some of the things that you just said in terms of what the actual might be, not just, well, there might not be the 10% skim, but is there any dollar amount being fixed or fixed put into that or any sort of percentage put into that?
I think the reality check this morning for the rail bill is nothing is certain. Mm-hmm. Everything is on the table. In addition to the things I mentioned, there's talk about a tax credit for low-income folks because, as you know, the GET's regressive. There's talking about a BRT, a bus rapid transit lane, connecting central Oahu to Pearl Highlands, any number of things. I think the main concern, according to Inouye, that her colleagues and leadership in the Senate have is they want to do something to help the highways, the state's roads, and they feel that they really have been underfunded and need support from the legislature. But it's interesting that this has become the vehicle for the state's issue when it's really about Oahu Rail.
And that seems to be the very interesting point about this, because we've been talking about some of the other issues like the skim, like the fact that our roads need to be refurbished for such a long time that it's kind of curious that it becomes the vehicle for potentially doing that through this, you know, rail surcharge bill.
Yeah, one of the uncertainties is there is a bill to increase the fuel tax, the vehicle weight tax.
Weight tax, yeah.
The registration fee. That's something that didn't make it out last year. The governor's pushing it. That could conceivably go through, or perhaps it will be combined into this bill. We just don't know. There's even talk about money for education and affordable housing. This bill is going to be something to behold. If it gets through, a vote is scheduled, a public hearing next Wednesday.
Yeah, I mean, but the overarching issue with this is how much the legislature is trying to cope with so many different issues and pack them into something that we thought was really only going to be about rail and GED.
And remember, this is a tax on Oahu residents. This is not, you know, a statewide issue, although there's talk about allowing the other counties. It could also levy a surcharge as long as it goes to transportation issues.
Really interesting. Going to be watching this one. Thank you so much. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Chad Blair joins us every day with a reality check. And one of the things staying the same about a Friday is that we all take a look at what's coming out of our news department in the coming week. And to help us do that, News Director Bill Dorman joins us. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
A change is a-coming.
Yeah, I tell you, this and that, as Chris mentioned in terms of time shift for the conversation. Another exciting part of that, though, is the encore presentation of the conversation at 7 o'clock at night, which will be different, but will be great, giving folks another option to listen to this show. On the news magazine front, morning edition is going to continue on HPR1, is going to extend all the way to 9 a.m., take away for an hour here and now after that, an NPR program new to HPR, and then an hour of All Things Considered at noon. But Derek Malama, here's a headline, is going to be part of the conversation in terms of joining a little morning news at the top of the hour. And also later in the program, joining to preview some community events that may be a bit under the radar.
Well, it'll be nice to have Derek join us. One of the things that we're looking at legislatively, though, is what happens with our older folks. And it hasn't been really a front and center issue in the way that it has been in years past. That doesn't mean that we're not talking about kupuna care.
Yeah, exactly, because it is always, as you know, in Hawaii, one of those issues that is lingering, that is existing, that is always with us. One new twist on this session is looking at the idea of keeping older folks in the workforce for longer. Just if you look nationally, that's also a trend. But then how do you do that here in Hawaii in a way that is supportive as well? And what can be done on the policy side to encourage that? What issues are going to come up? And also, by the way, how do you pay for that? And that's the focus of a bill, HB 607, coming up at the ledge. Wayne Yoshioka is going to be chasing that down next week.
All right. Well, we've talked about a few things and some things more than others. How about rail? I mean, we had a big discussion about that last night on Town Square. Just talked about what may happen with the GED.
Yeah, exactly. You know, rail is just one of those issues that really requires a number of perspectives and viewpoints. And one of the perspectives that sometimes gets lost a bit in this is the average citizen who says, wait a minute, let me step back from this. I'm a little confused in terms of what's...
How did we get here?
Yes, exactly. And the how did we get here part is an important part of this that can inform where we go, what our options are from here. And Mufi Hahnemann, certainly one of the big players in bringing us to where we are. Noe Tanigawa sat down with him and has some interesting perspectives on that, not just looking back, but also looking forward.
Well, we'll be looking forward to hearing those. And as we get into next week, where great change is about to happen. Thanks very much. And as we always say, on a Friday, Bill Dorman checks in with what's happening with our news department for the coming week. And next week will be quite something indeed. We hope you'll plan to join us. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Kaiser Permanente and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
We might have an image in our minds of the hermit as an angry recluse. That's what we've seen in our country lately, but author Bill Porter set out to learn what he could from hermits in today's China, heirs to a centuries-old spiritual tradition, and found something quite different. He's the author of Road to Heaven. He's speaking on Maui this evening, and we spoke with him yesterday morning.
In Asia, and specifically in China, was my experience. I had no idea that the tradition was alive and so well, and what an important role it plays in society. Or here in the West, our hermits are generally misanthropes. They want to be left alone.
Yeah.
In Asia, I think this, thinking about it historically or prehistorically, it probably goes back to the shamanic tradition, whereby in any small society, there are certain members who have certain sensitivities, and they to cultivate these sensitivities, they often leave their clan or the village and go off to the mountains maybe for a couple of days for visions or
sure.
to eat some plants. And so I think this, the hermit tradition in China, as civilization took over from Neolithic society, has plugged into this old role, whereby somebody who follows the Buddhist path or the Taoist path, or even in ancient times the Confucian path, the people who felt compelled to follow that path to the end eventually sought time alone. And it's sort of, I tell people, it's like getting a PhD in the religion of your choice.
Mm-hmm.
It takes about 3 to 5 years, generally. Most of the hermits I've interviewed spend about that long in the mountains by themselves. Some, of course, just stay forever, but generally it's about 3 to 5 years. And it doesn't make any sense to even try doing this if you don't have an undergraduate degree. That is, if you haven't already cultivated this path for a number of years with a teacher. And again, this was true in ancient times with the Confucians and the Taoists, and later when Buddhism arrived 2,000 years ago, it became the Buddhist way of life too, whereby some people would leave the monastery and go live alone for a while, and their teacher would often take them up to a specific mountain to get them settled and then say goodbye to them and wish them well.
Well, it sounds, Bill, it sounds like what you're saying is there's no point in doing this unless you have a proscribed path to follow.
Absolutely. Otherwise, you won't make it through the first winter.
Mm-hmm.
When my book was published in Chinese, it created a bit of a sensation. It sold 250,000 copies, and a lot of young people started going into the mountains, building huts. And, of course, you know, because the idea of having some solitude is one that appeals to all of us at certain times in our life,
sure,
regardless of whether we're ready for it. So a lot of people in China started going up into the mountains who weren't ready for it. But, you know, when I wrote my book, Road to Heaven, I interviewed hermits in the mountains south of Xi'an, and I estimated there were about 200 hermits in this one range of mountains called the Zhongnan Mountains. And
uh-huh.
3 years ago, a Chinese film company asked me to go back up to the same mountains and interview hermits who were still there or who'd newly come to the mountains. And the head of the film crew said he had read my book, and he had been interviewing the hermits in that mountain range, and he had personally filmed over 600 in the same area where there used to be 200. There are a lot more hermits today in China, three times more in this one area, and the education level is much higher. When I was doing my first interviews, they were rather simple people, just devoted to a religious path. But now I'm getting graduates of major universities, professors, lawyers, all kinds of professional people who have, you know, had the opportunity in modern China to become successful and make money and realize that that's not exactly what's going to make them happy. And so they also plug into this tradition.
But frequently, Bill, their goal, as you said, is not misanthropic. It might be to rejoin society as a more, you know, fulfilled person.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's they feel they can't help people unless it's like if you see somebody drowning and you don't know how to swim, you can't really help them.
But yeah,
learn how to swim, then you're able. So they feel they need to develop their mind to a point where they can help people emotionally, psychologically, by being able to talk with them and teach them something to liberate them from whatever is getting them down.
When the hermits that you've interviewed talk about the advantages of solitude, you know, the things that they gained from solitude, what do they talk about? You would think that the inability to escape from your own thoughts would be terrifying at some point, but I assume you have to work through that.
Well, yeah, it's often more like what you lose going into the mountains.
Uh-huh.
Of course, the like you say, your thoughts become a net that bind you every day. As soon as you have certain thoughts, you just focus on them and forget everything else. But although these people have been doing this in monasteries or temples or shrines or with masters for years prior to going to the mountains, so they've already sort of developed the basic skills of meditation, which allows you to see right through anything that's happening so that you can see they often like to describe it as just watching clouds pass by, and whereby your thoughts don't have any power over you. And you can, it's not that you want to stop having thoughts. The goal is to transform them so that your thoughts are the thoughts of helping people rather than doing things for yourself.
That's an interesting phrase, your thoughts having power over you. You know, obviously we want it to be just the opposite, but we can be imprisoned by obsessions and thoughts that we don't want, can't we?
Yeah, it's true. We think we're in charge, but as we build up attachments and obsessions, our thoughts take over for us.
So there's times to just get away and be alone, and that seems to have helped a great many people that you've spoken to.
Yeah, and again, this isn't. I think it would do us all good to spend some time alone, regardless of what kind of people we are. But this is just sort of a tradition that has been going on for several thousand years in China, whereby somebody devotes their lives to this path. and not just a couple of years. And with the hermit tradition being the very end of, not quite the end of the path, but getting the practitioners to a stage whereby they can come down the mountain and teach. Because when people who are looking for instruction can tell the difference with a teacher who is just teaching what they were taught, mm-hmm. or a teacher who has their own voice. And it's the people who have lived alone who really develop their own voice, their own way of talking and responding to people ad hoc rather than responding to people with a teaching they have memorized.
Bill Porter, also known as Red Pine, will speak in a Merwin Conservancy Green Room event tonight at 7 p.m. in the Maui Arts and Cultural Center's McCoy Studio Theater. His topic is The Search for Solitude, China's Hermit Tradition, based on his book Road to Heaven, Encounters with Chinese Hermits.
On February 4th, the Hawaii Arts Alliance honored former HPR President and General Manager Michael Titterton with the Alfred Price Award for his lifetime support of the arts and community building in Hawaii. At the event last Saturday, we asked those who attended about the impact the arts community made on their lives. This is some of what we heard.
Art makes human beings better. And it makes the world better.
Creativity opens my mind to some new ways of looking at things.
Creative people have connected me to others who participate in the arts.
Creativity is not something you should keep in your shirt pocket. You get much more by sharing than keep it close to the vest.
It's that foundation that made me understand what community and culture was all about. I think Hawaii is the place to understand that.
Creativity and the arts brings me joy and happiness.
I like the arts because it feeds my soul. And I love that we can all connect through the arts.
You heard Paula Hodges, Kitty Lagaretta, Andrea Snyder, George Vosikis, Richard Kennedy, and Nicole Brody recorded at last Saturday's Price Awards ceremony honoring former HPR President and General Manager Michael Titterton.
Earlier in the show, we asked you how Senator Hiram Fong earned the title of senior senator. Elected to the United States Senate in 1959, he became the first Asian American to serve as a United States senator, re-elected in 1964 and 1970, and eventually retiring in 1977. Senator Fong served as a Hawaii representative for 18 years. Now, you might wonder why his terms were renewed 6 years apart. That's due to the senior senator status bestowed upon him. When Senator Fong began his term in 1959, a coin was flipped to determine whether he would be considered the senior senator, allowing him to serve six-year terms, or if fellow Senator Orrin Long would carry that title. Senator Fong won the toss and made him senior senator, leaving Senator Long the title of junior senator. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, an online tool designed for parents to strengthen the school-home connection by creating continuity between classwork and homework. Achieve3000.com.
A new report says 13,000 people were killed in one Syrian prison known as the Slaughterhouse. Omar al-Shogra was almost one of them.
Like everyone else, I lied just to make torture stop, because everyone lies under torture.
I'm Robert Siegel. Stories from Sednaya this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at noon, following the world.
Beth Ann, a lot of people are putting their hopes these days in spontaneously created popular movements.
And we saw one that was spontaneously created about 3.5 years ago with Black Lives Matter.
Yeah. Using means that are available to everyone.
Well, as Patrice Cullors once said, that, you know, she took to social media because, you know, that's what her generation did and does. And from that point, there was a movement that was created. And we're seeing how that movement has moved, you know, nationally, internationally, and also allying itself with other organizations to bring about the kind of change that they see thwarted by a Trump presidency.
There are a great many precedents in American history to illustrate the power of an idea.
The power of an idea and then the actions behind it. And that's, I think, where they're at right now,
yeah,
too. What kind of actions will be necessary within and also outside of Black Lives Matter? We'll
exactly
be watching that, too. Now, that's it for this week. Coming up next week, we'll catch up with our county councils and talk about their priorities with council chairs.
And the creative director of the dance company, Ailey 2, talks about making every show different.
We're one show away from moving to our new time slot, airing at 11 a.m. on HPR 1. For our Hawaii Ion listeners, that means your dial should be set to 91.1 Hilo, 94.9 Waimea, and 95.7 Kailua Kona to hear us at 11 a.m. come Tuesday morning.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information, go to the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants. And today we say a fond aloha to Russell and wish him the best in his next endeavor.
That we do. The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello, and I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you on Monday when we pick up the conversation. Have a wonderful weekend.